This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
Welcome to the first edition of Where Did the Road Go for 2016. And tonight we're going to have part two of my interview with Shirley Black as she gets into her third near-death experience and a lot of the after effects and other stuff she went through. If you're a patron, you've already heard this. And if you want to become a patron, you can do so for $3 at the website. Go to wheredidtheroadgo.com. $3 a month gets you essentially a membership to the site. And there will be an actual member section eventually, but right now I'm just sending stuff out through Patreon. And there's going to be an extra segment from Cheryl Lee, something she started telling me about after we had gotten done. And it was really fascinating, so I had her tell it again for patrons. So that'll be up this week. So, without any further ado, here's part two of my conversation with Cheryl Lee Black.
All right, so this is the second part of our interview with Cheryl Lee Black about her near-death experiences and, well, beyond the after effects and other elements. And we left off last week talking about your second near-death experience and everything that happened after that that kind of shook your entire life up. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, did you ever have any experiences with shadow people after it?
Yeah, actually, you know, I did. I'm not sure if that was just me. It was funny. My first husband was actually quite psychic. he was an infantry soldier, and he was one of those, you know, lucky soldiers that always seemed to know what was coming at him. And he and I, our first house together, we bought a haunted house.
Really?
Yeah, it was kind of funny. And it never bothered me. That I loved that house. It's probably one of the favorite places I've ever lived. And I loved that house, and I always felt safe there and comfortable there and had slept the best there. But we had one bedroom that he couldn't sleep in by himself. If I were there, it was okay. If he were there by himself, he'd run out of there screaming in the middle of the night. And it wasn't just him. It sort of became a joke with us where, because he was, a young corporal in an infantry regiment, sometimes we'd have parties and we'd have, you know, young privates who drank too much and we didn't want to send them back to base. So we'd just say, oh, just go crash out on the spare bedroom there. And then the thing is, we would do this at parties and everyone would sit there and wait to see how long it would be before they'd run out screaming. And I mean, thinking back on it now, I was like, I was terrible back then. But, you know, you're, because I mean, we used to think it was hilarious, but it was like a shadow figure that was in that room. And I finally dealt with it because it was scaring the dog, but it didn't bother me when it was scaring young soldiers.
And how did you deal with it?
I kind of laid down the law and told it if it didn't leave the dog alone, I was going to play music that it absolutely hated. And apparently it did not like the Sex Pistols. Over and over and over again. Till finally it stopped. And, you know, and at the end, actually, even my ex-husband could sleep in that room without being expelled.
So was it still there when you left that house?
Yeah, there was actually more than one entity there or whatever. The really bad one, the one that seemed to cause everyone to run out screaming. That one I didn't really see much after I'd kind of
laid down the wall.
Yeah, essentially. But there was actually another one there that seemed like a woman. And the only things that she didn't like it if the dog went through the house with muddy feet.
Huh.
The dog would get chased out of certain spots if it were muddy. And yeah, so I mean, I used to keep the dog clean after that, not let her dig in the garden. And it didn't like men who weren't related to me staying over.
Mm. So,
which actually, my first husband, we weren't legally married at that point. So he still had issues with that one. Ah. Whereas my dad would stay in the house, nothing. Brothers were fine.
So was the shadow, do you think that was a person at one point, or?
I don't know what it was. Like, the shadow was the really scary one, and I didn't like the lady. Her I had no problem with, although, you know.
Does she seem like someone who lived there at one point?
Yeah, that's what I got from her, is that I was pretty sure she just lived there, and I never worried about her. And she seemed very protective of me. Whereas the other thing just seemed to scare everybody.
But was terrified of the Sex Pistols.
Apparently.
Huh. That's really interesting. So did you ever experience sleep paralysis with any of this?
No, I've never had that. Mm. And I know I could understand why you'd ask that. You know, because you would think that normally people who have night terrors and things like that, that's something associated with it.
Yeah, it tends to be sort of common.
Yeah, no, I've never had that.
And especially with your detachment, I would wonder if sometimes you weren't able to get back out, like if you were in an OBE state or something.
Oh, no, that was, my problem is staying in.
Right, no, that's what I mean, though, like if you're in an out-of-body state, did you ever have problems getting back in?
Yeah, well, so I don't really, it's once you realize that's where you are, I guess it was more just realizing that I was out was the trick with me. It took me a while before I understood that I wasn't in, but like I said, as I got older, I really kind of stopped having the OBEs as much until after the third NDE.
Mm, okay. Well, I guess the other question I wanted to throw at you, and this is just totally speculative, is why do you think it feels more real than real in these experiences?
Oh, that's a good question. Of course it is, because you're an interviewer and that's what you do. I think it has to do with the fact that it's like you have more senses, like everything, all of your senses are kind of mixed together, and
it's not going through the body anymore.
Yeah, but it's just a really pure form of information. Like, I don't know how, because it's like, you know, you smell colors and, you know, you taste numbers or however, it's all together.
Yeah, like what's it called? Synthanasia, I believe.
Yeah, synesthesia, but
yeah,
but better than that. I guess I didn't realize it, but apparently, according to one of the labs I went to, they say that I probably have a certain amount of synesthesia and sometimes I find that my way of experiencing gets to the point where everything starts to mix up more. Usually what I find, though, is that when I get that way is that I have difficulty with language.
Hmm. Yeah, I know. I noticed in the excerpts of the book you sent me, there's a couple of times where you said you couldn't form words after certain experiences.
Yeah, and you would think, like, anyone who'd known me for 5 minutes would kind of clue in that if I was having trouble finding words, that there was something off. I mean, you know, I mean, I'm just saying that that usually isn't a problem for me. And yet, yeah, when I get to the point where I'm able to have, you know, the kind of experiences we're studying in a laboratory, that I will often lose the capacity for language.
Wow. All right. Well, let's move on to your third near-death experience. And this was the last one you've had, right?
Yeah. That I would count like as a real NDE. I mean, there's a few borderline experiences where I guess would probably score high enough on the Grayson scale, but I don't really count them as NDEs. I just count them as like, you know, special OBEs, I guess. I mean, there's kind of a continuum. I mean, it, you know, in some ways, I don't think that it's just, you know, straight categories where things, you just drop them into a bucket and that's the category. I think there's kind of yeah, it's more of a spectrum of experiences out there.
Yeah.
And
so why don't you count the other ones? Were they not as impactful on you?
I think so. Yeah. There was one where it was an accident when I was in the military, and there was another person who was affected in the same accident, and we were both in the military infirmary, and I came out of my body and so did he, and I could see him and I'm sure he could see me.
Hmm.
And he freaked out pretty badly. And I tried to contact him. Like, I tried to talk to him about it afterwards, and he couldn't get away from me fast enough. And he put his release in immediately after that event and just disappeared as far as he could get from me.
Wow.
Like, it bothered him that much, where for me, it wasn't really that life-changing an experience.
Because it was kind of commonplace to you.
I guess so, yeah.
So this third one, I mean, this was a pretty bad experience for you.
Yeah. Well, it was bad in terms of
the physical world.
Yeah, in terms of what it did to my body. I wouldn't say, I mean, you know, I would call it a blissful, I mean, it's probably one of the happiest experiences of my life. You know, it's one of those weird things. It's like my scary near-death experience is like, you know, the blackest of the black for me. And this is,
yeah.
And this is like the lightest of the light. And I mean, there's just that, you know, there's just such a large spectrum of what you can feel when you sort of go from one to the other.
Yeah. Well, do you want to tell people a little of what happened that day?
Sure. Sure. Yeah, I know you'll keep me on track. I was married to my first husband at the time, and we were living in a rural area of Manitoba, which is on the Canadian prairies, near a provincial park. And I had a really good work situation at the time. I'd finished my first university degree, and I was working with an artillery regiment, teaching drums as my sort of semi full-time job. About 7 months of the year I was working with the military, and the other part of the year I was working as a landscape painter. And it was a great life. I mean, that part of my life, you just can't ask for a better life. I mean, I loved it. We had, you know, a house out in the middle of nowhere and right in the provincial park. It's just a beautiful place. And I loved my jobs, you know, and I was happily married. I mean, everything was great. And at the time it was in January, and it was one of those days where, I guess, you know, it's hard to explain to people who come from farther south, and it's hard to even imagine this year because it's raining here right now, and which, I mean, we're going to have an unusually warm Christmas here this year.
Yeah.
But, you know, on the Canadian prairies, if it gets below freezing in January, it's incredibly warm. You know, that's a shock. It never happens. And that had happened, you know, it was above freezing, and I wasn't going to lose a day like that. I drove to the provincial park, and I was going to spend the day in the park painting landscapes with my little dog Cassie with me. And we had just the most phenomenal day. And I have to say, you're going to choose, like, if you're going to choose your last day on Earth, that would have been a perfect day. It was phenomenal. I mean, we had lunch beside a frozen lake, you know, just sipping hot chocolate in the snow. It was just gorgeous. And, you know, I probably stayed later than I should have because it was starting to get dark, and it gets dark early in January in the prairies.
Right.
And I knew it would get cold once it went, you know, like things were kind of melting because it was above freezing. And I was driving on my way home, and I lost control of my car on black ice because as things were getting darker, the snow that was melted across the road froze up again. And I lost control of my car, and so did a large truck that was coming down the opposite side on the highway. So it was a head-on collision at highway speeds. And pretty much sheared my car in half. Because there was part of it in each side of the ditch. Yeah. And apparently it was a real fluke that I was even rescued in time, because after the truck hit my car, the driver's side kind of went along one side of the truck into the ditch, and the back of the large truck fell sideways and landed on top of my car and crushed it down to the dashboard.
Oh.
Yeah. So one of the things that saved me was that the driver's seat had broken, and I was flat on my back when the car crashed down on top of me. So I was underneath a truck in a ditch in half a car.
Man.
Yeah. So yeah, it's not in good shape. And I have no memory of that part of it at all.
Yeah.
What
kind of injuries did you sustain through this?
I had a lot of broken bones. You know, cracked ribs. My leg was really messed up. I think my kneecap was broken into 5 pieces.
Oh.
Yeah. A lot of broken fingers and toes, fractured skull.
Jeez.
Yeah. It was not, you know, and I mean, I just, my whole face was just full of glass. I was so cut up. You know, everything was just shredded by the glass. And I mean, this was before there were airbags in cars, so there was really, you know, nothing to protect me. And so injury wise, it was pretty bad. I was pretty mangled.
I'm not sure an airbag would have protected you that much at that point anyway.
Yeah, it might have protected me from the glass in the face.
Yeah.
You know, I'm very fortunate that somehow I managed not to get any glass in my eyes.
Yeah.
When everywhere else, I mean, glass in my nose, glass in my ears.
Man.
Everywhere else, my eyes were fine. Like, I have no idea.
What's the last thing you do remember of that incident?
The last thing I remember is my car radio started to go off. Like, it was weird because it went, when I was driving to the park, my car radio went to static in exactly the same spot. And then it picked up again. And it was like a brand new radio. It'd been a Christmas present. And you know, and I was thinking, you know, I was going to have to take it back to the, you know, to the shop that had just installed it because it wasn't working. And then it started working again as soon as I got to the park. And on the way back, it was working fine. And then the last thing I remember before the accident was that car radio went off. And that was kind of it.
All right. And then obviously you eventually woke up in the hospital.
Yeah, eventually a couple days later, I woke up in the hospital. Now, I'm not sure if I was actually conscious when they first pulled me out of the wreckage. I have no memory of that, but with a head injury, you lose that.
Yeah.
And I've only ever had kind of third-person accounts of what's, you know, of what other people said happened. I mean, there was a newspaper report. And it sounds like I might actually have been talking and conscious at first.
Hmm.
And then later succumbed to the head injuries, which is pretty common. And I mean, one of the things I was told, one of the things that actually saved my cognitive functioning was the fact that it was so cold.
Oh.
Yeah. Because nowadays they actually put people with those sort of injuries in kind of a hypothermic state.
Yeah.
And that was, it was because I was basically stuck under a truck in freezing temperatures for a while that probably saved a lot of my cognitive functioning. So it was, a lot of things were really, I mean, the fact that I got out of that accident was due to a lot of really lucky coincidences, because one of the, a witness to the accident happened to be on the volunteer fire department and got everyone together and had access to the heavy equipment they used to pull the truck off of my car. Like, mm-hmm. like you figure I was in a provincial park in the middle of nowhere in January, and they had me out of that wreck in about 20 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was just everybody who needed to be there just happened to be along that. I mean, it wasn't even like there's like the Trans-Canada Highway, which is like the one highway in Canada, as everyone jokes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, and this is like just a little provincial highway that went through the park that wasn't really used other than in the summertime. So the fact that there were everybody who needed to be there was there still blows me away when I think about it. I may have actually been conscious for a little bit, which is kind of weird when I think about it, because everyone talking to me would have thought I was conscious and would have thought I was capable of forming memories, and I wasn't. I mean, to me, that time is lost to me, and it's like I wasn't conscious at all. And yet, when I went unconscious for what everybody here would think about it, that's when I was having the most vivid, realer-than-real experiences of my life.
All right. You want to talk about those a little bit?
Yeah, that's, you know, I have to find words. Words suck. the first thing I kind of remember of that was being on this balcony of this apartment building that was in the middle of the wilderness where there shouldn't be any kind of an apartment building.
Hmm.
Strangely enough, my grandmother, who was deceased, and it wasn't the grandmother from the first NDE, it was my dad's mom who I'd grown up with, and she had died not that long before the accident, actually. And I mean, she was the grandma who, you know, suggested that I, draw on my sketchbook rather than freak out in school. And,
right,
you know,
right.
She was like the grandma who kind of got me. She was like the one person who understood me growing up. And that was who was there. And it never occurred to me that she shouldn't be there. Like, you know, everything seems so normal when you have an NDE, when you're there, it even with the distressing NDE, it didn't seem like this was weird.
Well, kind of like a dream state. I mean, you can have the most bizarre things happen in a dream state, and it doesn't occur to you until afterwards that, hey, that was weird.
Yeah, but when things like that happen in a dream, that's always when I figure out I'm dreaming.
Mm, true.
You know, like if something goes on in a dream, I'm really quick to go, this is a dream. But I...
Yeah, that's generally what happens with me, too. Something doesn't fit, and I think it out for a moment and go, oh... This is a dream. All right.
Yeah. You know, but you know, like I knew when I saw her that she was deceased and it was absolutely how it was supposed to be. Hmm. And everything was great. And, you know, I was just incredibly happy and loved. And, you know, it was realer than real. Information just seemed like pure, even though all the senses kind of mixed up together. But it, yeah. Instead of being mushy and not making any sense that way, they made way more sense that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like standing on the balcony, I could look down and I could see my little dog Cassie there.
And the dog didn't make it.
No. And I didn't find that out for weeks after I woke up in the hospital either. I could see Cassie in this meadow below. And I wanted to go down where she was. And I mean, she was doing great. She was happy. And I had every intention of going down with her. And my grandma stopped me.
Mm.
And I was really very frustrated by the fact that grandma stopped me because, you know, grandmas are supposed to be nice. You know, and it was hard to understand why I couldn't just go down there and be with her. And my grandma kept saying that she was going to get me through everything. And I was thinking, get me through what? I mean, this is great. There's nothing to get through. You know, it made absolutely no sense to me that she would say, there are things to get through. Because I didn't really have a sense of what I had left behind at all. I was just I was just home. You know? And... Oh, you're going to have to keep me on track here because I'm...
Well, where did the experience go from there?
There was a lot, too. I mean, there's so much that I can't really describe.
Mm-hmm.
But she kind of let me know that I could stay there on the balcony for a little while. But she kept saying I was going to have to go back. And I didn't really clue into go back to what.
And that's interesting because because you never got those memories back, that you couldn't remember what you came from.
That's true. Yeah, I guess I hadn't really thought of that way. You're right. I was in the car. Everything was great. I'd had a wonderful day. Yeah, you're right. So yeah, I had no clue that, you know, that I'd been smooshed under a truck.
Yeah.
You know, for a lack of better word to use.
Not many people get to say that, you know, after the fact.
Yeah. I guess so, yeah. But you know, like we talked about things for a while. It's funny because it wasn't like the life review the way people say, you know, everything flashes before you.
Right.
It was more that my grandma and I just kind of talked about life.
Hmm.
And I mean, she even told me some of her regrets in life about things that I had no clue about. Like one of the things was that she regretted being mean to my mom. My parents were married as teenagers. And my mom did not get along with grandma.
Yeah.
You know, and my grandmother was pretty hard on my mom, and I had no idea. I didn't even realize that my dad's family didn't like my mom's family. It didn't occur to me until after this NDE that, looking back, I don't recall ever seeing them all together at one dinner. You know, I mean, because there'd be dinners at one set of grandparents' house and there'd be dinners at the other family's house, you know.
It's just how things are.
Yeah. It didn't occur to me that, oh, they don't really get along because they didn't act that way. And so, you know, my grandma kind of told me some of the things about the things that she'd done to be mean to my mom that she regretted. And after the NDE, I actually asked my mom about that. And I found out, yeah, that grandma actually did that.
Wow.
Which is, you know, it was like, wow, my grandma could be mean. Who knew? I didn't ever guess that.
So you got a little bit of verification there, too.
Yeah.
At least for yourself.
Yeah, I did. I mean, there was, you know, a number of things, actually. And it wasn't just like the life review where you just find out what you did in the past. I actually got, like, things that were ahead of me. You know, and I actually tried really hard to avoid some of them. And it didn't work.
Huh.
Yeah, and but it was like it was funny because it wasn't like we were talking with words or anything either. There was all this information from her, and right. But it was just information. It wasn't language. It was just better than that. And even time, like even though I can think about my NDE kind of going sequentially, and it seems very orderly and it makes sense, but it also doesn't because there wasn't any time. Like it was just, it was kind
of just happened all at once.
Sort of. It's like, you know how now can mean like a little now, like right now, this instant.
Uh-huh.
But it's always now if you think about it. So now it's also kind of really big. So there's like a really big now and a really little now. And that's kind of how I think of it, that it was really big, but it was also really tiny and precise too.
Interesting.
You know, like there.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people describe that it feels like time doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. And yet, I know, and yet it doesn't make sense that, well, if it doesn't exist, how can you come up with a narrative?
Right.
That goes in an order, but you can't.
That's why it's so hard for you to come up with words.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, and.
Does it feel like you have to sort of dumb down the experience to express it in terms that this reality reflects?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah. It does, you know, and I mean, like I've talked a little bit about it in public and, you know, and I do, well, I'm, even here, you have to dumb it down because it doesn't really work otherwise. And I've sort of tried to be more open to things because I know that you're interested in it and, you know, like you were interested in hearing about the negative NDE, even though that's it. Kind of a no-no to talk about that one.
Well, that makes it even more interesting to me.
Yeah, but you're not normal.
That's true.
You know,
but also with things like that, I feel it's important that people out there know these things happen because chances are somebody listening to this show has had a negative near-death experience, and if they're afraid to talk about it because they think it means there's something wrong with them or that other people don't have these, they need to know that that's not the case.
Yeah. No, and I agree. And I know that if you only talk about the blissful NDEs, you're missing out half the experience.
Yeah.
And I in some ways, the dark NDE makes this NDE so much brighter.
Hmm. That makes sense.
You know, it's like, you know, it has to get dark out before you see the stars.
Yeah. All right, let's take a break right there, and we'll be right back with Cheryl Lee Black.
Where Did the Road Go can be heard first and usually live on WVBR, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern. Go to wheredidtheroadgo.com to ask questions of our live guests through the chat room. Where Did the Road Go is then re-aired on Dark Matter Radio and Deprogrammed Radio. You can download all shows for free on the website, and you can subscribe to us on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, or Vimeo. Additional content can be found on our video channels. You will also find our upcoming schedule, book reviews, blogs, free book downloads, links, and more. We are also on Facebook and Twitter, and if you want to help support the show, there are links to donate to us. Everything you need can be found at wheredidtheroadgo.com.
All right, and we're talking with Cheryl Lee Black. Am I saying that right again? Cheryl Lee?
You're doing good.
Or Cheryl Lee. Cheryl.
It's Cheryl Lee.
Okay. I'm sorry about that. And we were in the middle of discussing your most recent near-death experience. And how old were you when that happened?
I was 29.
Okay. And you saw things that were coming in your future, but you said you couldn't not let them happen.
Yeah, I mean, in one of the things I saw was that my future husband, the first thing I saw was that my marriage was going to end. And it was not going to end well. And I mean, I was really happily married at that point.
Right.
You know, I was absolutely, that guy was the love of my life. I couldn't imagine things not working out. And then nobody else could imagine it either. Like, it really came as a shock to people. And, what you hear about near-death experiences is that divorce rates are very high because you're different when you come back.
Right.
And when I came back, my first husband essentially accused me of killing his wife because I wasn't her.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I mean, he had a really tough background. He probably suffered from PTSD, and not just from the kinds of jobs he did in the military, but he came from an incredibly traumatic background and had almost died as a child at the hands of one of his mom's boyfriends.
Oh.
And then his grandparents got custody of him, so he was able to survive into adulthood. And, you know, all of his bad experiences made him one hell of a good infantry soldier.
Yeah.
But, of course, you know, that still kind of set him up for more things that made PTSD an issue. And he kind of got through life. He was a very rough guy when I met him. I mean, I met him through the military. I was working in the military. And he was not the kind of guy that I would have thought I'd ever be married to. Because he really was one of those absolutely scary dudes with dead eyes that go to parts of the world and do things that no government admits to.
Right.
He seemed to get through everything. When I first met him, he was like a party dude with a Camaro. Yeah, he had a gorgeous car. It was an old vintage Camaro. And I mean, within months of dating me, he had like sold the Camaro, bought a pickup truck. He bought a house. He adopted kittens. Next came a dog. I mean, it was like he was just handing me all the pieces and saying, here, build me a home. You know,
nice.
You know, like, I want a home. You can do this. You came from a nice background. Just do what your parents are doing and we'll be fine.
Right.
And that's kind of how it was. He kind of gave me all these pieces and we built this life. I mean, he asked me for years to marry him. He, you know, he got my relatives involved in talking me into it. I was not keen to get married that first time. And So, I mean, we finally did marry. We had life. Everything was great. And then I had this near-death experience, and I wasn't me anymore. And you can't be. You know, I tried really hard. I mean, I basically tried to impersonate myself, you know, and to be who I was before the accident. And yet I'd seen all of these things, you know, I kind of connected with that bigger self. And it wasn't so alien and adult as it seemed when I was a child.
Right.
Going through it. It was much more manageable somehow, although still you can't carry all that back here with you. But it's not as, well, I guess it's not as adult. but so I tried to impersonate myself, and he wasn't falling for it, and he knew. And it just got worse and worse. And he felt like he was off on winter warfare exercises when the accident happened. And they came to get him. And I guess they were expecting at that point for him to identify the body.
Right.
So it was not looking good at that point. And then when he got to the hospital, I was still alive and things were going okay. But when I first woke up, I didn't recognize him. And that was, that was horrible for him. And I don't remember that because I still wasn't able to form memories because of the head injuries.
Right.
And, you know, our marriage didn't really last very long after that. And because of the PTSD, he actually became quite dangerous to both of us.
Yeah.
Yeah. And,
now how much of this did you see when you were in that near death state?
I think I saw pretty much all of it, but I only carried so much back with me.
Gotcha.
You know, like, I think it was all there. I think there was a lot there because it seemed like I just knew everything when I was there. But coming back, there was only so much. But I do remember, you know, like, I remembered that it would get pretty bad. I mean, our marriage ended violently. And I'm very lucky that I survived it. That was actually the next time in my life where there was RSPK kicked in. Yeah, that's probably what saved me. I didn't know it was me doing it that time either. The whole house came alive and he ran out the door. And the next thing I knew, he'd actually gotten arrested because they thought he was crazy. Because he was dumb enough to say stuff, I'm guessing. I don't really know, but I know that they kept him for observation, so I'm thinking he probably said that he'd seen. Whereas I was there going, nothing happened. I don't remember any of that. Because I know better.
Yeah. You've learned that lesson.
Yeah, I'd learned that lesson. But that was one of the things that I saw during my NDE that did happen. And I tried very hard not to let it happen.
Did it leave you feeling just powerless as it was unfolding around you?
The thing is, when you have a near-death experience, you're much more sensitive to what people around you are feeling.
Mm.
You become much more empathic when you come back. And when you're married to somebody and you love them, you're already pretty empathic when it comes to that individual. Right. And so I was incredibly connected to him. And you have no idea how heartbreaking it is when the person you were that connected to wishes that you were dead.
Yeah.
And it just got to the point where I was just going to let him kill me. I just gave up. I knew that this was it, and I knew that that's what he was going to do that night, and I was just going to let him.
Wow.
Yeah. And then I don't know if it was my RSPK or both of our RSPK, or maybe some part of him didn't want to do it. Maybe, you know, like, I talked to a psychologist who knows about, you know, psychokinesis, believe it or not, there are some. And he said to me that it makes sense to him with the PTSD that on some part of him probably didn't want to do it, that he knew it was the disease that was trying to kill me, that he didn't really want to. Hmm. And that's why everything came alive and he ran out of the house and I hid under the table with the cat.
Wow.
Yeah.
But you had obviously seen more positive stuff in your future after that.
I did. I saw that I'd be getting married again. Mm-hmm. And I was very reluctant to that time too. I feel badly because, I mean, I love my husband dearly, but I made him like ask me over and over again for about 5 years before I said yes. So yeah. I like my independence. It's hard to give that up.
Fair enough. So you saw you had this conversation with your grandmother. Where did the experience go from there?
The experience itself, I mean, we started off on the balcony and then we kind of went inside to the apartment and we had tea and cookies.
How long did it feel like you were there?
It felt like a really long, long time. Hmm. Like I couldn't even put a time. Like, it seems strange that time was going by, but it didn't really. I mean, there was time, but there wasn't time.
Right.
So it's hard to say, but there just so much happened that it seems like it had to be like a really long, long, long time for all the conversations we had and all the cookies I ate. And, and I remember getting dark outside on the balcony. And, I remember thinking, it's funny because everyone asks me about the tunnel and I go, well, there was no tunnel. But when I sort of think back in it, that apartment was really long and skinny.
Hmm.
It was a long, skinny apartment and all the walls were lined with books.
Hmm.
It was just books as far as you could see in there.
So it was kind of like a tunnel.
Kind of, but I never thought of it until,
I mean, so how did the experience end?
She made me come back.
Ah.
I didn't want to. As I recall, she pushed me.
Ah.
So I remember seeing my body in the hospital and thinking, oh, first of all, I didn't recognize myself because it was not in good shape. I mean, it was just all purple and bloody and awful. And I didn't think I'd fit. I just seemed so much bigger than that body.
Hmm.
And she pushed me. And I remember thinking, how could you do that? Like, grandma, like, that isn't nice. grandmas are not supposed to be me. But, I kept seeing her, like, she kept her word about getting me through everything. I kept seeing her throughout my recovery. Well, I still see her sometimes, but she was there the whole time. I remember trying to tell the doctors, because, I mean, the doctors came and told me that I wasn't going to walk at first. And I looked at the guy and I said, of course I'm going to walk. Grandma's told me I was going to walk. Of course, I mean, everything's going to be fine. Grandma said so. And then they kind of say, well, you were hit really hard.
Well, sure.
Yeah. And I mean, at one point they sent a psychologist in to talk to me and he was trying to convince me about, just the direness of my situation. And I'm like going, no, that everything's fine. Yeah, well, but I mean, everything was fine. I mean, I get around just fine.
How long did it take you to recover?
To be able to do some things took quite a while. I think walking upstairs normally took 2 years.
Wow.
But I mean, I was in the military. I was playing drums, marching with a drum on parade within months of the accident. You know, I did the C-Fest parade in Vancouver in September. The accident was in January. So C-Fest parade in which is like 5 miles going up and down hills and playing. So, yeah, I recovered much faster and much more extensively than was expected of me. You know, and then some things I seem to do better, as you know, as much as I always joke that one of the things I got good at was math. I was horrible at math before the accident. Like, it just, it was not my thing. I had a fine arts degree. I was not really good at science and math at all.
Right, right.
I swear, if you take a musician or an artist and hit them really hard, they learn math. you know, and that was, and that was one of the things that actually kind of betrayed me as being different, was the fact that I wanted to go back to university and get a science degree. And everyone was like, no, 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 you don't want to do that.
Now, you said you saw this accident coming back in your, was it your previous near-death experience?
Yeah.
So you knew this was it exactly as it played out in that experience?
You know, it's one of those things where until you're there, like, you know, even though you know it's coming, until you're there, you don't realize this is it. Like, this is what I've had.
What you saw, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I kind of talked myself out of it for a long time. It's funny, my first husband actually didn't want me to get a driver's license either, because he had nightmares about me being in a car accident. And, you know, and I didn't for the longest time, but at that point we were living kind of out in the middle of nowhere. He was in the infantry and he was gone a lot of the time, and I needed a car to just to get groceries and stuff when he wasn't there. And so it really wasn't an option not to get a driver's license.
Right, right.
And so
did you know how old you were going to be at the time when this happened, or was it just something in your future?
No, I had no idea.
Okay.
How old specifically I was going to be. It was just, I remember that I knew that was coming. Like I said, it's one of those things where when you're in the near-death experience, like, you have all this knowledge and you just get fragments of it when you get back here.
Yeah.
You know?
What did you see, I don't know if you've even tested this, but did you see any change in your IQ through the three experiences?
Well, it's hard to go from the first one because I was so little.
Right, right, yeah.
I mean, I was precocious, to say the least. I mean, I started school early, and my mom always used to laugh about how I could sign my name before my older brother could, because she used to take me cross-border shopping, and you could bring back stuff if you could sign your name. And I, you know, and I could do that before kindergarten, so. And he couldn't.
Wow.
And he couldn't. And it's hard to say after the second one, because I don't know. I mean, I might have been, but I wasn't really tested beforehand because I was doing okay in school. I wasn't causing trouble. I only had all the IQ tests done afterwards, and they were fairly high, but I don't know if it jumped up higher again after the third one or not. I just know that I got good at math. And I mean,
right.
My first university degree was in fine arts. And I mean, I worked as an artist and a musician. And then after the third one, I went back and did a degree in geological sciences and did a master's degree.
Did you lose anything, like any of the artistic ability or anything?
I didn't lose it, but it didn't satisfy me in the same way. It's hard to explain, but I mean, it used to be when I was in my studio painting that I just knew that that's what I was on the planet to do. You know, like, I was, anytime I was in my studio, that's always how I felt. Like, this is just everything I need to be doing. And after the accident, it didn't make me feel that way anymore. It just, it wasn't enough. It was part of it, but it wasn't enough. I wanted more. I wanted to know more about the world. I was just curious about things in a different way. I just couldn't get enough knowledge.
And you didn't end up with anything that resembled brain damage either.
It doesn't seem likely.
Nonetheless, brain damage makes you good at math.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I mean, I was still, you know, it was weeks after the accident when I was playing in the band. And I mean, the guys had set up my drum on a stand for me, and they were kind of holding me up so I could play. But you know, even though at that point I was suffering some memory loss, there were weird things that I couldn't remember how to do when I got back. I didn't know how to work a can opener. I didn't know how cans got opened. And there was no internet for me to look it up back then. And I mean, I went for months where I was cooking everything from scratch to avoid cans. Because I didn't want anyone to know. I didn't know how to open them.
Did it just come back to you at some point, or did you have to ask someone?
I saw it on a TV commercial.
Ah, and then it was just like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. I saw it on TV. I learned everything that I needed to learn from television. Yeah. You know, so there were things that I lost, but I was able to play really complicated music. I mean, I was a Highland drummer, and I don't know if you know that much about, you know, pipe bands, but the drumming is an absolute art form. I mean, it's much more specific and precise and complicated than any other type of drumming I've done. And I had no difficulty whatsoever, like within 2 weeks of getting out of the hospital, of just playing those complex scores from memory. You know, I didn't lose that.
There's something about music that it works with our brains in such like a native sort of way that it seems to be remembered more than normal everyday things.
Yeah.
It's the patterns or something to it.
Yeah, it's language, but it's without words.
Yeah, yeah. And our brains are just hardwired to deal with it. It's like it's supposed to be there.
Yeah.
Which is really weird when you think about it, because why would it be?
I don't know. Like, it seems like such a big part of what you experience, even in an NDE. There's certainly music. It's
really?
It's part of the information.
Oh, wow. Is it music you can actually remember? Or do you just know there was music there?
I just know there was music there, but it wasn't like anything I'd heard here, and I don't think I could replicate it. But I remember there was music there. And it seemed to have just incredible meaning. Like, and almost consciousness itself.
Wow. All right. What were some of the after effects of this experience?
Well, I mean, I told you there was poltergeist activity.
Right. Right. Did that increase even more so?
Well, that was just one really big kind of booming experience of it.
Okay.
But I think that I became much more electrically sensitive, like in electronics and lights and things became my enemies. and I mean, back then there just wasn't as much of that around. So it wasn't as big a deal. I mean, you know, as I've gotten older, it's become more problematic because, you know, I have to share my universe with computers now. And
yeah, and they don't like those electrical instabilities.
No, they don't.
are you one of the people that knocks out streetlights?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do that. And my husband laughs. And I get annoyed at him because he'll kind of bug me to see if it'll set it off. He thinks it's funny.
Okay, that is kind of funny.
It's not funny. It must be a guy thing. It's, I don't know.
And you also said you had some experience. This is actually how we started talking. You said you had some experiences with Kundalini because of this as well, right? Was it the third one that set it off?
I would say, actually, yeah. I mean, I didn't really, I didn't know what Kundalini was. So,
yeah.
So, yeah, I know. When I actually, OBEs apparently are considered part of that, according to some of the stuff I've read by Barbara Whitfield.
Mm.
Who has mentioned that, which I wouldn't have guessed that was a part of it. I mean, certainly, you know, feeling kind of blissed out, like, you know, because it's not uncommon to kind of feel connected to that light again.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly when I was in art school, I actually seeing auras is considered part of Kundalini.
Yes.
Yeah. And I mean, that for me started after the second NDE.
Well, it seems like Kundalini actually sets all these other abilities off as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it's hard to say which is the cause and which is the effect.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you know, like, does Kundalini make you more likely to remember a near-death experience, or does having a near-death experience make you more likely to report Kundalini?
Right. Yeah, that's a very good question.
Yeah, and
I know Dr. Ring, when he did his work, that was one of the findings he had, is that so many people with near-death experiences also had Kundalini symptoms, and people who reported UFO abductions.
Yeah, I know. And I was actually surprised, you know, when I found that out, because you always think, how can they be like us? there's this us and them, like there's NDEers, yeah, and then there's UFO people.
But I mean, if you think about your second experience there and the things that happened to you afterwards, where you'd feel these things in your room, I mean, that's part of the abduction experience.
Yeah, it is. I know.
It's a different face, but it's the same archetype of the experience.
No, I know. And I felt, and there were times when I felt myself being pulled away from my body and taken away.
Yeah.
You know?
So there's obviously a connection here somewhere. And I mean, I think it almost begs that you have to toss out the extraterrestrial idea. Yeah. And a lot of people have a hard time with that because it's what it looks like.
Yeah.
But just like in your near-death experiences, when, you know, I mean, people seem to have, it seems to be morphic to some degree. And it seems like these encounters also seem to have some morphic elements. They're fairies back in the day, and now they're electronic, you know, spaceships, and they change based on our expectations.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I mean, I know Ken, he came up with the term, what was it, experiencer prone personality.
Yeah.
And he was very disappointed that didn't catch on.
And it should have, because it's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
There's definitely a personality type who's more likely to have these experiences, not because they're hallucinations, but because maybe their boundaries between this world and the next are a little thinner.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think that's kind of, you know, that's one of the nice things about, you know, having a Ken Ring to write a book with.
Yes, I'm sure.
You know, apart from the fact that, you know, his main job is to, you know, pat me on the head and say, there.
And I mean, when I read that book, I was very much for the extraterrestrial hypothesis. I thought Bud Hopkins made a good case for it with the hybrids and that. And I read his book and I went, all right, my whole world just got shifted, because if this is accurate, then what's really going on? Why are these experiences connected?
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, a lot of near-death experiencers have abduction type experiences too, but they don't talk about it because the feeling, I mean, I've talked to a number of people who've said this, that it's okay to talk about a near-death experience because that's kind of okay now, you know, Proof of Heaven came out and suddenly we can talk and it's okay. But it's not okay, like, if you talk about things that aren't accepted, like UFO experiences. So that part of it, you don't speak of. And
and
yet it's actually pretty common to have both. And that was I mean, it's like, you know, these, a near-death experience is just, it's like it's sacred, you know, like it's so personal and special. And I mean, in some ways you want to tell the world about it because it just seems important, like people should know. But on the other hand, you don't want to tell anyone about it because it's really precious to you and special, yeah, and you want to keep it and protect it. And the idea that if that's going to be tarnished by admitting to having other experiences,
yeah,
you don't want to do that.
It doesn't seem like the near-death work is as much of a victim to the ridicule factor as somebody who has had a UFO experience.
It's not, yeah. It just isn't. And I think, I mean, part of that is, unfortunately, because it's been co-opted a little bit by people who use it to kind of push religious ideas.
Sure,
you know, or various ideas. I mean, it gets turned into religion a lot.
Well, even with the debunkers, I mean, they'll acknowledge the experience has happened. They'll say, you know, it's the work of a dying brain. And even though that doesn't make any sense when you look at it, you know, at least they're accepting that these experiences do happen. They're just trying to explain them away.
Yeah, that's right. They're trying to find a physical reason for it. And right. and of course, you can't also explain away, like, there's a lot of really good research showing that there's the changes, you know, that there are profound, yeah, changes in people who have these experiences.
And normal, like, hallucinations and stuff don't do that.
No. And I mean, and that's something that I think the near-death community of researchers has done a really good job of, is showing, you know, how these experiences change people in ways that mental illness and drugs and, you know, like, one of the things I've seen Bruce Grayson talk about is how with mental illness, if you medicate mental illness, you can control it. Uh-huh. But you can't medicate away a near-death experience and what it does to you.
Yeah. Right.
And there's a really big difference there.
And that makes perfect sense. I mean, because it's a different effect.
Yeah.
You're having a profound experience and you're connecting to something other as opposed to just hallucinating within the confines of your mind.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, like, if you look at, say, Eben Alexander's experience, he actually had some parts of his situation where he was having hallucinations and as he was coming back.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, having a near-death experience doesn't preclude the other things.
Right. Oh, of course not.
You know, so you have to kind of be able to separate the different issues that can be there.
And it seems like, as we were saying, that the mind and your expectation plays a big part in what you're experiencing and what you're seeing, which means that it's not empirically real like things here. I mean, like, we can all agree that, you know, this is a table or that's a chair. Even though we don't know that it actually looks the same to each other, we can at least come to a common agreement on it. Whereas there, it seems to be very, very subjective. The archetype seems to be intact, but the details seem to be subjective based on beliefs, deep down beliefs too, not just what someone says they believe.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, like, I know for what I experienced that, it's like there are no words for it. There just aren't. I mean, I try really hard. I've done my best to come up with words. And when I have to put words into it, I'm basically changing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
you're limiting it by applying definitions to,
yeah,
it.
Yeah. You know, I'm changing what it is and I'm changing it to fit with who I am and yeah, how I experienced this world and how I was brought up and my culture and everything else. And yet those things really have nothing to do with the actual experience itself.
Hmm. So when you had the last experience, did you see yourself writing a book in the future?
You're like the book conspiracy people. All of my life, people had said, have told me you're going to write a book, and I've always said no. It's just, you know, I mean, I was not, writing was just never something I saw myself interested in doing. I was one of those people who wrote their essays on the way to university on the day it was due to be handed in, and back when you could give them handwritten ones.
Right.
And yeah, that was the amount of effort I'd put into those things.
So it wasn't in your future visions?
It was not. Huh. It was just one of those things that everybody has been telling me as long as I can remember that I do know.
Well, maybe it was and you just don't remember.
Oh, it's quite possible. Or I'd have looked for ways to, you know, not go there.
I don't want to write a book. I'm not going to remember that.
Well, or you know, if I'd remembered it, I might have stopped myself. Who knows? Yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes it's so funny because, you know, where my book starts, like you've got the introduction and it starts at a conference. And you've seen the talk that I actually gave.
Yep.
And at the end of that talk, everybody's saying, so do you have a book out? Like, no, no, stop. And that whole conference, everyone kept saying, so when are you writing a book?
Well, you have such a wealth of experiences. It just seems like a natural fit.
I guess so, but I didn't think I'd ever get to the point where I could talk about it. You know, I mean, I've said things in the last couple hours here talking with you that I haven't actually said before.
Ah.
So.
Well, I hope people appreciate it. And I hope it's helpful to them. Like I said, I know we have listeners who have had near-death experiences. And I hope, you know, people hearing what you went through and the stuff that's happened to you will help them as well.
Yeah, I think that there's this misconception that you have a near-death experience and everything's great.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, gee, you talked to God and you saw the light and yay. And
I mean, imagine if you could go back to that, to the kid you were after the second one and explain better to her or to your parents at the time what was going on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, my parents were at such a loss. They couldn't understand what had happened to me.
It's like, okay, sit down. Here's the deal.
Yeah, I know. I mean, because let's face it, that was before there was even a name for the experience. It was before Moody's book came out.
Ah.
You know, so nobody had a name for that experience.
Yeah. So it was just, you were just a bad kid.
Yeah. I was just a bad kid. And they tried to fit into, you know, like mental illness or is she being abused or, you know, all of these things that they, you know, could understand. And now that's not what it was.
And you obviously from what you've talked about, you don't have one of the key things from the, from Ring's, encounter prone personality, or experience prone personality, which was the, childhood abuse. You actually grew up in a very loving household.
I did, but then I had abusive teachers.
True.
You know, and so, yeah, I mean, I guess if you're looking for kind of trauma, I mean, I think the distressing NDE itself was trauma.
Yeah. Oh, certainly.
Yeah. But you're right. Before that point, I was a happy kid. And like I said, I grew up in a nice family. My parents are nice. You know, they're been married forever. They've known each other since they were kids.
Wow.
Yeah. So yeah, I was fortunate not to have that, but then I did have the distressing experience. I did have abuse of teachers, and unfortunately my first marriage ended in violence.
Yeah. But that those things wouldn't have created, you know, a mental state that would have allowed the near-death experience. The near-death experiences had already happened.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true.
All right. So that covers about a third of maybe of all the stuff I wanted to talk to you about. But we're going to wait, and we're going to bring you back when you publish your book, so people can, have something to go find after they hear you talk about everything else.
You're so optimistic.
Because you have been you've done various tests on some of these abilities, and you have a bunch of other experiences we can get into. But like I said, we're going to save those till next year.
I'm sure you must be tired of talking to me by now.
So I thank you, and I thank you for talking so candidly about all of this stuff.
Well, thanks for asking me. I didn't know I'd actually say so much.
All right.
But you did.
All right, and that concludes my talk with Sherilee Black. As I said, we'll have her back eventually to talk even more about the experiments and stuff that have been done with her, and even more of her after effects once her book is released. And we're going to end things off with some Psyche Corporation. And this is the final track on her new EP, Romance of the Counter Elite. This is a song called Nine Lives. See you next week.
In my country, the children are born with nine lives, and they choose the 8 week as to sacrifice.
Survive.